this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Bahati Mutisia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Teen Magazine. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Rookie Magazine and Teen Vogue. For the last program, I did not get a chance to read an article from Teen Vogue's OG history series, so I'll be reading two articles from that magazine and then one article from Rookie Magazine. Let's start with Rookie Magazine. This article is titled, Going the Distance. I chose aviation studies because I'd never heard of a female pilot who was also a refugee. This is by Maya Ghazal and was published on June 20th in 2018. My life in Syria was pretty normal. I lived between my big extended family and lots of friends. I wanted to go to university to study political science. I had it all planned until war broke out and changed everything. My dad had to leave us in 2014 as the situation worsened in Damascus, where we lived. It wasn't safe for my brothers and me to go to school. I had to change schools three times because every school I went to either got surrounded by the army or the area around it got too involved in the war. The last school was the closest, but that doesn't mean it was the safest. My dad ended up in the UK, and we were so happy to know that he was safe and that eventually we would reunite. Arriving in the UK, I had great expectations, big hopes, and dreams. I thought life would get easier, happier, then gradually go back to normal, but it didn't. I expected our new neighbors to welcome us with a basket filled with chocolate and their phone numbers in case we ever needed help. I expected to start school immediately, meet people, and make friends, but nothing went that way. I was rejected from three schools and a college as they had no idea how to treat my Syrian GCSE, General Certificate of Secondary Education. Sometimes a rejection came with a nicely written letter. Sometimes it was just mean and harsh. I told them to test me, to test my knowledge, but they weren't willing. I was given no reason for my rejection, and the only explanation I could find was that I was being stereotyped. People have conscious or unconscious biases against refugees, maybe because they only know what they've seen in the media. They think that displaced people from Syria are uneducated, but that wasn't true for me, and I wasn't even given a chance to prove myself. After about 3 months of not interacting with people in my new community, I had the chance to give a speech at an Eid al-Fitr event held by a charity called the Children's Society. Although my English was only starting to sound normal, I wanted to embrace the opportunity to speak up about my situation and to interact with others. After my speech, one staff member from TCS, Roseanne, told me that I sounded amazing and that she would love if I would help them to help other young people. I felt like life had finally opened its doors to me. Roseanne was like a light in my darkness. Her words made me believe in myself again, and she made me feel that my work on my language had been effective. I wanted to be helpful, and so I proudly accepted her offer. I know that it's not always easy to change how you think, but I trust that when people listen to my story, they will understand. Whether through volunteering, speaking with TCS, or even studying, I want to show that refugees want to live normal lives. I want to give back to the country that welcomed me and to the people who helped me. I believe that when people listen to what we have to say with enough compassion, real change becomes possible. I used to be very nervous and shy about sharing my story. I wasn't sure how people would react, but so far, I have only been met with care, support, and compassion. Public speaking has helped me build confidence and believe in myself, in my message, and in its effectiveness. It's made me better at English, and it's made it easier for me to connect with others. In fact, I'm now the one my friends call on to talk to our teachers to ask for extensions. As soon as I get into a discussion with anyone about anything, I start talking with my hands, and then the other person asks, "Are you a public speaker?" I could figure it out by the way that you move your hands when you talk. Whoever knows Maya as a friend, in the uni, at work, or from a group event, also knows Maya the speaker. But speaker Maya and normal Maya are just me. I can't represent all refugees, but I can try my best to share my story. As a refugee, yes, but also as a Syrian, a female, a dreamer, a student, an engineer to be. Maybe the combination of my identities can even help change someone's stereotype of a refugee. Gaining a place in university was only my first step, and I feel the pressure to ace my exams not only from myself, but to prove that refugees are capable of success. That a refugee can start over from zero, learn a new language, and excel in their education. That you can be anyone in this world and still be a refugee, as it is a living status and not a referendum on whether you're a good or a bad person. I want audiences to recognize that refugees are facing, I'm sorry, I want audiences to recognize what refugees are facing and learn how to help. I want refugees to be allowed to dream, to think outside the box, and to define our own futures. In my interviews at potential schools, the admissions officials often ask what I wanted to study in university. I always said political science and that I wanted to work in politics. As soon as I said the word politics, the officials would interrupt and say it wasn't a good fit for me, it would be too hard for me, or that a lot of people struggle with it. To them, our meetings were insignificant. But I remember them because it made me change my course for the better. I became enchanted with the view of airplanes departing and landing at Heathrow Airport. I wanted to be in the middle of it. I remember looking at my mom and saying, "That is what I want to do now." I submitted my application to different universities to study aviation engineering, because people call it a masculine field. And I think everyone should do what they love, regardless of any labels. I enjoyed math and physics, and I knew how few female pilots there are. Plus, I'd never heard of a female pilot who was also a refugee. The idea of becoming a pilot is still new to me. I know I will face a lot of challenges to become one. I know I will face people who stereotype Arab people as unsafe. But hopefully, after I put in the work, I will have the ability to access any country. The same respected person just doing her job of flying an airplane will be the same person who was once turned away and underestimated, who was once called an outsider, who was once looked at as a burden by some countries. I am just at the beginning of my journey, and I will do whatever I can to achieve what I want and prove that everything is possible. And hopefully inspire other people along the way. Well, that concludes that article. And of course, that was published in June of 2018. So I hope that Maya is still pursuing her dream of becoming a pilot. Okay, now we'll dive into the Teen Vogue OG History Series, which is a series where we unearth history not told through a white, cis-heteropatriarchal lens. And this article is titled "How the Electoral College is Tied to Slavery and the Three-Fifths Compromise." This is an important election year, and I'm sure you all have learned or will be learning about the Electoral College and the Three-Fifths Compromise in school. So I wanted to read this article on its important history. And in this article, Maya Francis, the author, explains the Electoral College's historical ties to slavery in the United States. And this was published on July 14th, 2020. White supremacy is systemic. It lives in policies like law and order policing and access to public goods and services. It thrives in politics with systems that Americans rely on to elect leaders, like the Electoral College, a process originally designed to protect the influence of white slave owners, which is still used today to determine presidential elections. At the Constitutional Convention in 1787, state delegates came together to draft what would become the U.S. Constitution, establishing the rule of law for the newly founded United States of America. The country, still in its infancy, had liberated itself from the colonial rule of Great Britain's King George III in the American Revolution. With George Washington presiding, the delegates discussed the current state of affairs among the 13 states governed under the Articles of Confederation, which was proving insufficient in maintaining federal governments among the states. At the urging of Virginia delegate James Madison and others, they began to draft a new national constitution, which would design the role and power of the new government, including elections of head of state. But steeped in the throes of the slave trade, and a little less than 100 years before the Civil War, there was already a divide between the interests of northern and southern states. The idea of a simple popular vote election struck fear in delegates from the slaveholding states, because while their states boasted large populations, much of the populace was comprised of enslaved black people who could not vote. By contrast, northern states had smaller populations with a greater number of eligible voters, meaning white, male, and generally property owning. The right of suffrage was much more diffusive in the northern than the southern states, and the latter could have no influence in the election on the score of Negroes, said Madison, who would later become the nation's fourth president. The substitution of electors obviated this difficulty and seemed, on the whole, to be liable to the fewest objections. Fearful of being outnumbered, Madison pushed for the Electoral College and championed representative government by state as a solution. Seats in the House of Representatives would be based on population size, and delegates from slaveholding states sought to have slaves included in the count for total population. Those opposed recognized this would mean fewer seats from the smaller states. And so the states made several compromises. The first, known as the Three-Fifths Compromise, was a racist, manipulative policy that outlined the rules for legislative representation and taxation of the states. It read, "Representatives and direct taxes shall be apportioned among the several states which may be included within this union according to their respective numbers, which shall be determined by adding the whole number of free persons, including those bound to service for a term of years, and excluding Indians not taxed, 3/5 of all other persons." Enslaved black people, ordinarily only regarded as property, were declared 3/5 of a person in order to strengthen the power of the white men who kept them in bondage. It would remain that way until the 14th Amendment granted citizenship to slaves in 1868. The second compromise was the advent of the Electoral College in deciding the general election. Instead of popular votes, electors would make selections on behalf of their states. The way electors were chosen varied by state, but they were usually elected officials and party leaders, as is true today. The number of electors for each state was set to equal its total number of congressional representatives, 2 senators, and however many representatives it had in the House. In 1961, the District of Columbia would be awarded 3 electoral votes as well. There is no federal law that governs how electors cast their vote. This, too, is determined by state law, both now and then. Candidates had to receive a majority of electoral votes to win an election. So, in deciding how to elect the leaders of government, Slaveholding states were advantaged by the size of their slaveholding population. Virginia, which boasted the largest total population, saw many of its own occupy the White House in the early years of presidency, including Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Madison. The impact of the Electoral College and the dominance of Southern electors is even clearer when considering how many presidents were slave owners themselves, 12 in all, including 8 who owned slaves while in office. Still, many others endorsed states' rights coded language that's still used today, with the introduction of emerging voter suppression laws designed to alienate and disenfranchise voters. Since its creation, there have been 4 elections where the Electoral College winner did not receive the popular vote. 2 have come this century: the 2000 election between Al Gore and George W. Bush, and the 2016 election between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. Both of these instances have drawn the ire of Electoral College critics, who say the system is outdated and should be replaced with one person, one vote, direct elections that truly represent American democracy. Okay, and the next article in the OG history series for Teen Vogue is titled, Japanese American Teens Are Confronting History by Visiting World War II Former Incarceration Camps. This article is by Taylor Week and was published May 8, 2019. Making the drive from Los Angeles with her friends, 19-year-old Sydney Takeda didn't know what would be waiting for her at the Manzanar National Historic Site, where one of the 10 incarceration camps that imprisoned Japanese Americans in World War II once stood. It was an early Saturday morning, but it was already almost 90 degrees out in the desert. Sydney looked out the car window and realized she was seeing what more than 10,000 Japanese Americans were seeing in 1942, when they had to pack their suitcases, leave their homes behind, and board trains, buses, cars, and trucks that led them into rows of barracks standing behind barbed wire. "My friends and I were like, 'There's absolutely nothing out here,'" Sydney tells Teen Vogue. "Lots of thoughts were racing through my mind, like, what would it feel like if I was to be on this train taken to camp, having no idea what was to come and what would happen to us?" Sydney was one of over 2,000 people who made the trek to the foot of the Sierra Nevada mountains on April 27th for the 50th anniversary of the annual pilgrimage to Manzanar. Held each April, the Manzanar pilgrimage serves to educate the public on an important example of civil rights violations in United States history, and to encourage individuals to ensure their fellow Americans' constitutional rights are never stripped away again. The Manzanar pilgrimage is just one of several pilgrimages made to former World War II campsites throughout the year. Other camps designated by the War Relocation Authority, which is the federal agency established specifically to provide for the incarceration of Japanese Americans, include Pawston and Gila River in Arizona, Tula Lake in California, Minidoka in Idaho, Topaz in Utah, Heart Mountain in Wyoming, Amachi in Colorado, and Jerome and Rower in Arkansas. Sydney hoped she would be able to unearth some of the family history that has eluded her most of her life. During World War II, her grandmother was incarcerated in Gila River, and her grandfather was in Topaz. She had never asked them about their experiences. They were among the more than 110,000 held in camps between 1942 and 1945. As a result of an execution order requiring the forced removal of Japanese Americans to what the government referred to as relocation centers, Sydney first learned about incarceration not through family stories, but in school. I came home from school asking my parents about it, and all I really found out was that my grandparents were children during the war and basically grew up in camps, Sydney said. My dad didn't know much either because my grandparents never spoke about it. Many descendants of camp survivors grew up without learning about the camps because their families never discussed it, whether out of embarrassment, shame, or painful memories associated with being imprisoned. Being detained in camps by the U.S. government interrupted thousands of lives. Japanese American children were plucked from their schools, some right before they could graduate and earn their diplomas. Families lost their businesses and farms, and because people were allowed to only bring what they could carry with them to camp, they had to sell their furniture and belongings. Japanese Americans fared no better once in camp, where they were assigned identification tags that made them feel like cattle, and watchtowers loomed over them as they made their way to school or the mess hall. Because the camps were isolated from the rest of American society in deserts, swamps, and mountain regions, they faced extreme weather conditions from which their flimsy barracks failed to protect. By standing outside in the heat and Manzanar, pilgrims like Sydney were able to get a small taste of what daily life was like for Japanese Americans in camp. The first official pilgrimage to Manzanar was originated in 1969 by a group of young Japanese Americans who, like Sydney, were seeking to understand what had happened to their families during the war. They knew their families faced racism in their communities, which intensified after Japan bombed Pearl Harbor in 1941, leading to the U.S. to enter World War II. They knew that President Franklin D. Roosevelt passed Executive Order 9066 in 1942, violating the rights of thousands of American citizens. They knew the camps were shut down in 1945, and their families had to find housing and apply for jobs, rebuilding their lives all over again. But the trauma their parents and grandparents endured, and what that meant for their children, as well as the community's future, were issues that lingered long after the camps closed. Prior to the war, at the turn of the century, there had been over 40 Japan towns in the United States, enclaves that celebrated and catered to the Japanese American community. That number dwindled after 1945, partly due to the displacement of families who took the jobs they could find after camp. Bruce Embry, a co-chair of the Manzanar Committee, son of Sue Kunitomi Embry and one of the founding members of the pilgrimage, tells Team Vogue the inaugural gathering was the first step of a long healing process for the Japanese American community. The pilgrimage forced the community to come to grips with what happened, and to understand why Japanese American community centers like Little Tokyo in Los Angeles were disrupted, Bruce tells Teen Vogue. It later empowered the community as a whole to seek redress. Without the pilgrimages, there wouldn't be a venue, a way for the community to come together and think about it. In the 1970s, the pilgrimage became a site for community activists to organize around the issue of redress for Japanese Americans, which they achieved with the Civil Liberties Act of 1988. After the September 11th terrorist attacks, the pilgrimage was a safe space for the community to offer support to the Muslim community, which was being treated with the same kind of xenophobia many Japanese Americans recognized well. And in 2019, the pilgrimage evolved into a multicultural gathering whose participants have called for solidarity with other targeted communities and condemned current events like the so-called Muslim bans and a proposed Muslim registry, as well as the separation and imprisonment of asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border. The 50th anniversary program featured several speakers, including Nihad Awad, the co-founder of the Council of American Islamic Relations, who shared his memories of 9/11, saying, "An attack on one community is an attack on all of us." Warren Furutani, another pilgrimage co-founder, emceed the program. One of the keynote speakers was Karen Korematsu, founder of the Fred T. Korematsu Institute and daughter of Fred Korematsu, whose objection to being forced into camp led to the infamous court case that upheld the legality of incarceration. "We have skin in the game. This is our history," Karen tells Teen Vogue about the necessity of holding annual pilgrimages. "If we don't take the time to continue to educate others and share this history, it's going to disappear." Karen encouraged young attendees to exercise their right to vote, as well as to go home and ask their parents about their own family sacrifices, because once you know your own story, you can appreciate and support the stories of others. The program closed with a procession of banners, each representing one of the 10 camps. Sydney listened for the numbers of the imprisoned announced after Gila River and Topaz, silently recognizing her grandparents. Now she wants to return home to Sacramento. Though her grandfather has passed away, Sydney says she feels an urgency to hear her grandmother's story and a responsibility to preserve it and share it with others. "I felt so trapped in those few hours I was at that site," Sydney says. "I can't imagine how much this confinement took away from these people's lives and from my grandmother's lives. And from my grandparents' lives. It makes it much more real when you're there." Okay, well, that concludes the articles. But before I close, I want to read two pieces of advice from the article I started at the last program. This is advice from therapists that people are sharing. And Deja's therapist said, "Make mental lists of all the things you can control in a situation and put positive power to those." Deja says, "If someone was making decisions that upset me, I wasn't able to change what they were doing, but I could change my response to that behavior, or I can change the amount of communication I have with that person." Another good one I found, Evelyn's therapist said, "Change your perspective and everything else will fall into place." Evelyn's thoughts, "I would make situations out of nothing, speak impulsively, and had moments where I would be screaming to get my point across. A lot of it stemmed from not feeling that I was up to my family's standards. My therapist made me realize that it's my mindset that has to change, and my overall outlook on my natural abilities to succeed." And that concludes today's episode. Hope you listen next time. This is Bahati Mutisia reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Teen Magazines is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening.